Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 96th numbered episode of Super Podcast. I am your very lovely host, Super Marcy, and not with me today is my untrustworthy co-host, Bede. That's not really true, he is trusty, but he is at the Melbourne Film Festival, so he cannot join us. Instead, I found two replacements, so guess it's a big welcome back to both AJ and Sam. Hi, guys.
Howdy, howdy.
Hey, how you doing?
Awesome. And I did not make that entrance awkward, or intro awkward.
No, not at all.
Yay!
I can only hope I'm awful enough to replace Bede.
Awful American, you got a lot to live up to.
I know.
Yeah.
So, I guess the question has to be, why are you awful this week?
Yeah, why are you an awful American, AJ?
Okay, well, awful American, this week I've watched The Watch, actually, the new idiot frat boy overgrown man children comedy that just irritated the living hell out of me.
You know what upsets me about that? Rosemary DeWitt deserves better.
Mm-hmm. And she basically, her role in the movie is pretty much the same as Rosamund Pike in The Big Year, where she just worries about, like, I want to have a baby, Ben Stiller. When are we going to have a baby? That's her only role in the entire movie. And
that's Rosamund Pike's in The Big Year. That's a shame, too. I love Rosamund Pike.
Yeah. And there's just so much talent involved here, because it has Richard Ayoade from the IT Crowd, and it has all these talented guys like Billy Crudup's in there, and it's got Arlie Ermey, and it's got all these talented, like, comic minds, and it's just wasted on the most inane, worth bullshit script that just has them like, hey, we got an alien, let's take pictures of us, and it looks like we're screwing it. There, you've got the entire sense of humor of The Watch right there.
Is that their commentary on Abu Ghraib, then? You know, let's suppose, like, we're screwing the alien. Or is it not that small?
No, it's not. It's just filled with so many of these, like, improv sequences where it's like, Vince Vaughn has this one bit where he goes on for, like, two straight minutes, taking out, like, you know those Russian dolls that have one inside the other?
Babushka?
Just 2 minutes of taking them open and going, oh my god, there's another one, you guys. Oh, this is great. And I just wanted to reach into the screen and slap the ever-loving shit out of that poor dickhead.
Yeah, it's too bad you can't actually do that when there's something irritating in the movie.
3D goes the wrong direction.
Yeah, you know? Well, that was kind of like how I felt, because I'm an awesome Australian, because I got to see Killer Joe this week, thanks to Sam's recommendation. And I wanted to beat the crap out of Emil Hirsch in this movie, because his character is such a fucking dumbass.
See, this is where they're
all dumb.
That was a bit... AJ, say that again,
I was gonna say, this is where Last Action Hero was onto something. We just need to make a magic movie ticket that'll allow us to go into the movies and beat the ever-loving shit out of characters. It's beautiful.
Exactly.
Last Action Hero was onto something in a lot more ways than that. I really like The Last Action Hero.
As do I.
It's a really good movie.
It is a really good movie. I don't think audiences understood it back then.
Yeah.
But yeah, Killer Joe was fantastic, so thank you,
not
Sam.
you're welcome. That was weird. Yeah. Last Action Hero reference in the middle of you talking about Killer Joe.
It makes perfect sense. Yeah, well...
No, it doesn't.
The way that we made it there, I mean, I said I wanted to beat the shit out of Emil Hirsch, and AJ commented that movie was onto something about going into the movie, so it makes perfect sense.
But we're not actually talking about Killer Joe or The Last Action Hero or any of that.
Those will come in a later podcast. Our topic is actually one of my favorite directors and people in general, and I'm sure he is for a lot of people, and that would be the legendary Joe Dante. Yay!
I'm a big fan of his Inferno. that's comedy.
See,
that is. That really is.
Yes, strictly speaking, I suppose so.
hey.
Actually, in all seriousness, who doesn't want to see Joe Dante's Inferno?
I would be down for that movie.
Because there would be a lot of puppets involved.
I'm down. I think I'm going to send him this podcast so he can hear that pitch.
Yeah. If you're hearing out there, I will give you whatever I need. Get a Kickstarter going. Like, I'm your guy.
Yep. We'll That's make it point. Happen, Joe Dante and Joe Dante's Inferno.
I'm sure he's never heard that joke before.
Probably never, but he's probably never heard people actually wanting to Kickstarter it. That made sense in my head, though. Yeah. Anyway, we are just going to go through his career, I guess, chronologically from the beginning, and we'll mention a few other things that he's done more recently as well that film-related, but isn't like he hasn't directed them kind of thing. Yeah, so I believe... He got his start editing trailers for Roger Corman. Which,
what are the chances?
who would have ever guessed that he did that?
Yeah.
but I think this led to his, I guess, first real feature, which was Hollywood Boulevard, which he co-directed with Alan Arkosh, who also, I think, edited the edited trailers, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm, no, that sounds right.
Yeah, so. And yeah, Hollywood Boulevard, which is one I actually haven't seen. It wasn't too easy for me to get a hold of. I know that it is a comedy, and it's kind of about Hollywood and stuff like that. I'm just talking out of my ass.
I've got no idea about this one. I've never seen it. I don't know that it's been available here, actually. I'm really not sure. Certainly I've never seen a copy.
I want to say that's one of the movies that they talked about in the Corman's World documentary. I think it was like Arkish and Dante were talking about how they made it like super cheap just by making it a movie about making movies.
Yeah.
And just presented it as this really weird comedy to save money.
Yeah, and I think it was the, I guess, first official pairing of Dante with Dick Miller.
And the rest is history.
Which is, yeah, I mean, you could, talking of documentaries, there's a film to be made just on that collaboration, really, which has, you know, gone through, I think, all of Dante's films to date.
Yeah, it started in 1976, and I believe Dick Miller was in his latest, The Hole.
Oh, he's definitely in The Hole. I remember that. I saw that.
I will get to that. We'll get to that a bit later. But then Dante, his next movie would be a kind of... would I be right in saying it was kind of spoofing / ripping off Jaws with Piranha?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a, it's kind of essentially an asylum film, but, you know, breaking the asylum mold, as it were, before it was made, I suppose, by actually not being shit.
I really enjoy
Piranha.
Yes. Piranha is actually a really fun and good sort of creature feature, kind of exploitation-y type. But, yeah, I mean, you know, back then they were doing what The Asylum does now, except those films just weren't... I don't know, there was something more special about those films back then. Whereas the Asylum kind of, I don't know.
I think there's a cynicism to it now.
Mm.
You know, and also, it does come down to a certain degree to me to film just looks better than digital video, you know, and I'll forgive more stuff if somebody's, you know, put some effort into making a good looking film. Whereas with the Asylum stuff that I've seen, it's all been on sort of quite sloppy, high-end DV. And it just doesn't look like film to me, which is a problem. But the thing about Piranha, and I think this carries through Dante's career, is that it's a film that, and this is something else that you don't really see in other sort of rip-off movies that happen nowadays, really speaks to a love of film. And there's a real sort of glee about it. You know, he's obviously spoofing Jaws, he's obviously ripping off Jaws, but there's a love of Jaws and of B-movies and of all of these actors and these techniques that he's using. And, you know, for all its roughness around the edges, there's a charm about it because Dante is clearly having so much fun. And that is something that I find, you know, translates to a crew of actors, translates to a crew, and translates to an audience. And that's what's so great about Piranha, and I think that does carry through many of his films.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, I totally didn't like that movie. I'll give it this over the Alexander Aja version. It wasn't as shrill and annoying. It was still a pretty basic kind of creature feature. It had that kind of semi-serious thing going for it, where it was a little bit jokey, but not just so tough, so far removed that it was an official spoof. But even still, it was kind of, at the end, I just kind of sat there going, well, that existed. But, like, I kind of understand the love it's got going for it. It was just not really much anything special for me. It's a good first step towards a career of making better movies.
I would agree with that as well. I mean, I don't think it's anything like his best work. Though, you know, there is stuff I prefer it to. But, you know, the thing about the Aja version, I mean, there's a crassness about it that, you know, even down to, I mean, there is some nudity in Piranha, and it is a bit exploitative. You know, it's an exploitation movie. That stuff's going to happen. But there's such a crassness to some of it in Alexander Aja's film that, you know, it really sort of goes through that barrier and comes out the other side. I just, you know, that underwater nude scene with Kelly Brook, and you just, like, I mean, first of all, it's no fun because the 3D is so shitty that you can't see it anyway, and second of all, it serves absolutely no purpose, and you just, this is no fun on any level, and it really should be. And, you know, I don't know, again, practical versus CG, you know, I know what wins for me. I do agree with you, AJ. It's not a perfect film by any means, but I think it's fun and, you know, done with enough wit and enough sort of verb that it's very enjoyable.
Yeah.
I agree with you, because when I did my dissection on Joe Dante, Piranha was actually one of the movies I hadn't seen of his. And I really, to be honest, wasn't really expecting too much, but it really surprised me. I had a really good time with it. So, yeah, I definitely agree on that. I guess there's nothing else we can say. So, The Howling?
Helen.
Who wants to go first? Unless you want me to go first.
I can take this one. I do have to admit though, like I literally have not seen The Howling since 1999. But and for the most part, my memories of the series are kind of tainted because it wasn't long after that that I saw Howling 2 and 3, and I just wanted to swear off the entire series. Like, to this day, those are still, like, in my, like, top 10, like, worst movies I've ever seen.
What was the name of The Howling 2? I think it was in the UK, was She-Bitch or something?
I think you're about a werewolf bitch.
That's the one.
Oh, I thought that was Your Sister is a Werewolf, or is that Howling 3?
No, that's another title.
Yeah. Howling 3 was Marsupials or whatever.
Yeah.
That was the one they did in Australia.
Which are fucking wolves, by the way. I'm just saying.
But yeah, there was like, it was a huge drop-off in quality. Perhaps, like, in all of horror, the biggest drop-off in quality from a first movie to a second movie. Because The Howling, I watched, I do remember back when I had my Angel Fire site, and that's how...
Angel Fire.
I know, and I did like a Werewolf Week of Reviews, so I finally watched, you know, American Werewolf in London, and The Howling and stuff, and I really remember being struck by how intense The Howling was. Like, till that point, like, all the werewolf movies I had seen were either kind of like, you know, the Lon Chaney Wolfman or kind of like really jokey ones. It's like, okay, let's see what this one's all about. And yeah, like right from the get-go in that whole theater sequence, you could tell that this was a different beast. No pun intended. Actually, yes, it was. I'm sorry.
I don't know. I probably need to see The Howling again. But I've tried a few times with it, and it's one of my least favorite Joe Dante films, I think. Mainly because, in a lot of ways, it seems the least Joe Dante of his movies to me, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that feels most like just a horror movie.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And, yeah, but, yeah, I mean, just to say that's not quite what I'm after with Dante, really, because I love his movies because they're so specific to him, and The Howling kind of feels to me like a werewolf movie, and, I mean, I need to go back to it and decide how good a werewolf movie, but there's not much that's... or that struck me anyway on the couple of times that I've seen it as being particularly unique or feeling particularly like it came, like it is of this director, which is kind of what I look for from him.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons why I've wanted to kind of go back and revisit it, one, last time I saw it, I was still in middle school, and two is that over the years I've heard about everyone talk about how good, like, the dark comedy was in there, and that's not something that I really remember the first time around. It's like, when I saw American Werewolf in London, I picked up on that, like, on the gout humor, like, away.
It's kind of more subtle.
Yeah.
Howling.
Yeah, so that's all the more reason, like, now when I'm kind of older and I've seen a lot more and grown used to kind of more downplayed humor, just kind of revisit it and see if I can spot it, what everyone's kind of talking about.
I mean, I saw The Howling when I was a lot younger, and I liked it okay. It was really different for, you know, things I had seen at that point. And, you know, back then I was a really big fan of An American Werewolf in London, and I saw this and I had, you know, they came out around the same year, I believe, but it was just, you know, it's complete opposite, and this was, you know, a lot, it was, you know, played a bit more straight, and it had this very weird kind of, I don't know, almost cult-like thing going on with it, which, you know, being younger, it kind of took me off guard, but you know, upon my more recent rewatch, I actually really enjoyed it a lot. And I think that, you know, Dante did a really great job of building up suspense and setting the, you know, this atmosphere. And, you know, the story really is kind of creepy. And I, you know, got the killer in it, played by Robert Picardo. He scared the crap mm-hmm. out of me. Like, he's a very genuinely creepy character. And it's, yeah. I mean, he's another kind of regular for Dante as well. I think
this was their first film together, yeah. wasn't it, as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, seeing it again when I was older, I definitely appreciated it more. And I actually think Dee Wallace is really, really good in it. And I think it's actually one of my favorite things that she's done. Yeah, and that's about all I can say on The Howling.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I think it's something that I will definitely go back to, that I should give another go around to. But yeah, it's not one that won me over quite as much as some of the others. I think maybe because it doesn't feature as much of the stuff that I really like about Dante's cinema as some of the others, you know? Just because it plays it a little more straight. At least that's my memory of it.
I would say, yeah, give it a fresh kind of rewatch and, you know, maybe you'll feel a bit different.
It's on the shelves, you know, so it's there for me to reach down.
But resist the temptation to watch any of those godforsaken sequels, please.
Yeah. If you need watch Obscurus Looper review them, because that'll do.
I've seen quite a lot of those, actually, yeah.
They're quite entertaining, because she's reviewing it and she knows what she's doing. I guess the next movie would be the Twilight Zone movie, which consisted, I think, of 4 segments, maybe?
Correct.
Wrong.
And like a kind of a wraparound story.
Yeah. So Dante, everyone did segments. I believe it was Dante, John Landis, Steven Spielberg, and George Miller.
Yep.
I'm saying that like, I hope I'm right because I did not pull up the page for it. It's been too long since I've seen this, so I can't really comment on what Dante did with it, but
Never seen it.
Well, AJ can take this one. He can give us his thoughts on it.
I can. I remember not long after my parents like first got HBO, like some of the first movies I kind of watched on there were like Memoir of an Invisible Man and awesome. Killer Clowns from Outer Space. And
awesome.
I remember the 2000 movie. I know. Hell yeah, HBO was the shit.
Yeah, it was the shit.
But I remember one afternoon seeing, like, the Twilight Zone movie, and I turned it on about, like, halfway through, so it was, like, just ending the whole scene, or the whole segment, the Spielberg segment, which was in the old folks' home and had Scatman Crothers with, like, the magic tin can and the old people getting young, and it's like, oh, that's pretty good. Oh, we got a new one coming up. And in about, like, 10 minutes, Joe Dante sends you into the ninth circle of cartoon hell, where it's, like, this kid who can make anything come true with his mind. Just, like, has his family held hostage. He's, like, has them all, like, sentenced to watch cartoons in every single room. He summons one to, like, eat his sister and, like, another family member he has. Has like her mouth taken away, and there's all these weird creatures and stuff. So for you, Sam, like everything that like was that Joe Dante took away from The Howling about himself, he just crammed it into about a good 30 minutes or so into his Twilight Zone movie segment. It's just a lot of crazy energy, a lot of weird monsters and stuff, and it is just totally nuts.
That sounds awesome. I mean, I've been meaning to see Twilight Zone for so many years for various reasons. But yeah, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, need to rewatch it.
That says something, because the segment after that is the George Miller one, where it's John Lithgow doing a remake of the William Shatner one. It's like, there's a gremlin on the plane! Except Lithgow was just like screaming and pale and crying. Yeah. But it's like, no, you had like the bad wolf, like in full scary ass puppet form in the Joe Dante segment. So he tried hard, but Dante won.
Mm. Yeah, I think I'll need to rewatch it, and Sam, I think, should watch it for the first time. And this would lead I guess Dante's probably most famous movie. Definitely one of the most popular movies, which would be Gremlins. And I guess I'll start off for Gremlins. This is a movie that I grew up with. It's from the year I was born, if anyone wants to know how old I am. So when I was younger and it was on video, I watched this a lot. And, you know, at the time of being a kid, it was kind of, you know, it's funny, but it also had, you know, a bit of a really messed up horror vibe to it with the actual gremlins when they show up. And these things are just insane. And it's amazing what they got away with for something, you know, I guess a lot of kids watched it. Like, I was a kid and watched it. But it's just one of those really fun and funny movies that, you know, combines a bit of horror in there. And, I mean, what can I say that hasn't been said already about it? It's fun. And, you know, I think Dante did a really great job of just injecting so much of himself in it. But he still kept, like, the spirit of what was written by Chris Columbus as well. But, yeah.
That's kind of what amazes me about Gremlins, is that a movie that good was written by Chris Columbus. I mean, Chris Columbus is not exactly renowned for his skill in really any department, but particularly writing. I mean, that's one of the things that is really genuinely great about Gremlins is it does have a fantastically well-constructed and clever and witty screenplay. So, you know, I don't know really what happened to Chris Columbus in the sort of intervening years between that and the likes of fucking Bicentennial Man. But he appeared to lose all of his edge, which is a real shame. But, man, I love Gremlins so much. Like you, I'm a little older, but like you, I grew up on this movie very much. I didn't get to see it at the cinema, obviously. I was only 3 when Gremlins came out. But I did, I think, start watching it on video when I was really much younger than I should have been.
Well, I would definitely watch it when I was way too young for it.
I think a lot of parents kind of assumed that it was a friendlier movie than it was. Because Gizmo is so cuddly.
Gizmo is just set so at Christmas. Cute. I want a Gizmo, and I won't break the rules because I don't like gremlins. They're ugly little shits.
Well, I mean, let's not get into the rules, because we could get into the whole debate about, isn't it always after midnight?
There is that. But maybe they know when it's night time in wherever they are.
Yes, but where does the clock work for, and how does that...
Well, yeah, they just know that it's night time wherever they are, and then they know that it's daytime because the sun's out. I don't know, I'm just talking out of my ass.
But as I said, let's not, shall
well,
we?
Well, this that will lead us that. Into a bit of discussion on Gremlins 2, which we'll get to soon.
I haven't even nearly finished on Gremlins. I love how it's basically a totally subversive, sick version of It's a Wonderful Life. It's like It's a Wonderful Life with scaly little monsters running around. It's just fantastic. The way that Dante, and this is what I love so much about his cinema, just in general, is he takes this, all-American milieu, the outwardly sweet, friendly, welcoming, almost picture postcard America, and then he throws monsters at it and turns it on its head and tells you a story about how Phoebe Kate's dad died while pretending to be Santa Claus and climbing down the chimney, and it's this brilliantly, it's cinema as this fantastically twisted mirror of, the way that America that sort of tried to present itself through movies, and now Joe Dante's just sort of lobbing monsters at that. It's fantastic.
It is fantastic.
Wonderfully subversive. I love that about this movie and about many of his others.
It really does show you how good of a director Joe Dante is when, like, at the beginning, like, he really establishes this place as, like, this very, like, nostalgically tinted small town, and he makes it look, like, really appealing, and it's, like, average small town America, like, everyone knows your name, and he sets up that world really perfectly, and he gets, like, the cute little gizmo to come in there, and then just completely tears down the place in the darkest ways imaginable, and it's funny, and it's just really disturbing at times, because you totally buy that this world exists.
Yeah, and actually, I think the performances go a long way to that as well, because, I mean, yes, everything's very heightened, it's all sort of a type, and particularly, Hoyt Axton coming in with his, very avuncular performance and all of that, but it's actually really nicely acted, and everyone sort of gets the tone so well that you buy, like you said, you buy into it's called Bedford Falls, isn't it? But you really buy into this sort of small town life, and the sort of local heroes and villains and all of this, Mrs. Deagle and her ceramic snowman and all that stuff. It's all very nicely drawn sort of within the fiction. There are just so many kind of cool characters from like Billy, who it's kind of very easy to root for, to the very cool science teacher at the local high school, right down to, Mrs. Deagle, the panto villain. It's all, really great fun in that respect, and nicely drawn in that respect, I think.
Yeah. Definitely. AJ, have anything to add?
I don't know, it's like you said, like, what else can you say about Gremlins? Like, it's Gremlins, and it rocks.
Pretty much.
Well, the other thing we should talk about is how cool the technology is, and how great the puppets are.
It's awesome. I mean, this is a movie that proves that practical effects and creations can work so much better than computer generated stuff, and this movie looks so much better than a lot of stuff we've seen, over the last 10 years of, having so much like CG and,
Well, it's not that the animation is bad when it comes to CG. The thing that's always lacking, and the thing that this has, is presence, is weight.
It does. They have character. And I'm not saying that CG is bad. Some of it can be amazing. Some of it can really have that character. But, you know, not everything can have such a big budget.
That's not what I mean. Not character. Physical weight.
Yeah.
That's what's missing. You know, you can look at Peter Jackson's King Kong, for example, and you take a look at that alongside the 1933 version, and, you know, obviously, technologically, Jackson's King Kong looks much better, but he doesn't have the physical presence. He still essentially is just a collection of pixels, whereas the puppet in the 33 version, the puppets here, are actual things. They're there. They're moving around. They're interacting with things. I mean, sometimes they're not doing it perfectly, and by all accounts, Gremlins was an absolute nightmare to make.
Well, they were.
I understand that the puppeteers actually added the scene with Gizmo on the dartboard because they were so frustrated at the limitations of the puppet. So they just wanted an excuse to throw darts at him.
Probably sounds about right, but it just, I mean, this is, like, one of the best examples of, like, you know, creating these characters. And they look, I mean, they look real. There's, you know, but there's so much to them. Yeah, but there's just so much to them. And I just think that is something that's lacking today, even if things, you know, can look really fantastic. But as I said, some things have bigger budgets than others, and some, you know, characters and stuff, you know, they can look and feel, you know, real. But I just don't think it can compare to something like this.
Yeah, and what's amazing is that for Gremlins 2, in terms of creature design, Joe Dante really stepped up his game, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, and, you know, Gremlins, of course, you know, the Gremlins kind of have their own, like, personality and distinct look, which I think was a really smart idea.
Well, I mean, that's something that's slightly less prevalent in Gremlins than it is in Gremlins 2. You only really have one who's sort of truly individual in Gremlins, which is Stripe. But he does have a real personality, and also so does Gizmo, you know. I defy anyone not to want a Gizmo, the end of Gremlins. But
I want him.
If there's anything bad I can say about Gremlins, is that because of that, we got Munchies, Ghoulies, Hobgoblins.
And a bit later, fucking Furbies.
I was going to say Furbies, but let me just, this is completely off topic, and I really want the answer to this question. Ghoulies, why the hell are they continuously shown in a toilet when they're not even in a toilet in the first movie?
Because
that's not an answer.
It's a hell of a VHS cover. I think more people know that cover than have seen the movie.
Well, yeah, I remember it Ghoulies, much, but I watched Ghoulies. It's stupid, and they're not in the toilet. I just wanted to see these things in the toilet, and they weren't in the damn toilet. And I don't know, I was so heartbroken, I didn't want to watch part two because I didn't know if they were going to be in the toilet.
They were in a toilet in part two.
Okay, I'm going to have to watch part two to see the toilet. But, yeah, that confuses me. But anyway.
You're a strange person.
Really? Did you just discover that now?
No.
Ghoulies are just disgusting. And I just thought they lived in the toilet. And I was disappointed when they didn't. Anyway. Let's move along.
Gremlins is awesome.
Okay, so next was Explorers, and I haven't seen this for such a long time, and I don't know what I can say on it. I just distinctly remember it being a really fun, you know, sci-fi kids movie, and you have River Phoenix and Ethan Hawke. Hawk. I find it weird.
I doubt I've seen it in 20 years. So, obviously, it's going to be hard for me to comment on this one.
I've just never seen it at all, so I can't comment.
Well, I would say it's worth checking out. I mean, I do want to revisit it at some point, and I'm sure I'll really enjoy it.
I definitely want to go back to it. I remember it being a sort of kinda cuddlier film as a sort of follow-up to Gremlins. Mm. I think it's still a use certificate over here, so it's definitely a sort of friendlier film than we're kind of used to from Dante. And I do, though, want to go back to it, if only because somewhat unfashionably, I would say, I'm actually quite a big Ethan Hawke fan. I think he's a really solid actor, and I really should go back to that among some of his other early stuff. So
yeah, I'm a big Ethan Hawke fan too. So after that was Inner Space.
Another one I have not seen.
This is now, just this fun. Basically, that's the way I would describe it. It's fun. It's, you know, it's definitely aimed at a bit of an older audience, I think, because I think things definitely would go over a kid's head with this movie.
Though I've got to say, I really enjoyed it when I was a kid as well.
But yeah, I do remember seeing it as a kid.
Years ago, I really enjoyed it again.
Yeah.
AJ, have you seen Fantastic Voyage?
Another one I have not seen. I know the premise of it, that they're kind of the same, but obviously Inner Space is a lot more kind of humor-centric.
Yeah. I mean, Inner Space is sort of halfway between spoof and remake of Fantastic Voyage. And it really straddles that line actually really well. Martin Short is kind of a hit and miss guy, I think, in movies. But he
definitely hit and miss.
There's something about there's a madcap energy to him in this that I think Dante harnesses really nicely. And actually, the same with Dennis Quaid. There's a really great quality to him in this.
Yeah, where, I really like him in this movie.
I think he's another person who can kind of go either way in movies. He can be really charming. He can also be tremendously smarmy.
If you want to see the worst thing, I think I've... No, wait, two. Of just the worst pieces of shit Dennis Quaid has made, Beneath the Darkness, I think it was called, and that fucking Legion. Ugh.
Yeah, I mean, that turns me off. And I saw Pandorum recently. That's not very good. Yeah.
It's not very good. It's better than those two.
That was a real shame because Ben Foster's great anyway in
anything,
thing, but not so much.
That movie was just a big letdown.
But Inner Space is a lot of fun. He hits the sort of all-American charm thing really nicely as this sort of test pilot who's employed to go in this miniaturized sub and meant to go into a rabbit but accidentally gets injected into Martin Short's ass. Well, that's what happens, isn't it? Unless I'm misremembering. But it's a really nice combination of elements, actually. There's some really fun sort of almost body swap comedy and fish out of water comedy with, Martin Short and Dennis Quaid. So there's almost a sort of all of me kind of vibe to their stuff in the way that, there's almost a possession sort of thing to it as well. But it also combines that really nicely with a sort of comedy thriller with Robert Picardo pursuing them as well, trying to get the technology. And and also with the sci-fi stuff, it's really, there's almost sort of three genres all bound up in Martin Short's body in this movie. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Please don't make me think about Martin Short's body.
No.
You're kind of going to have to.
Especially if he's in his Jiminy Glick getup.
No, I don't
really know that reference very well, but okay.
Yeah, you don't want to know that reference. Should we move on to the next one?
Please?
I guess so, or but AJ, I'd be interested in what you make of Inner Space. I think it's a lot of fun.
I've heard it's a lot of fun. It's just one of those movies that I keep meaning to see and it slips my mind, but I'll keep it in mind because of this glorious podcast.
Yes. Well, the next one is something called Amazon Women on the Moon, which I think just has directors doing segments, and I've never seen it. I know nothing about it. I have nothing to say on it.
I saw it 2 days ago for the first time.
There you go. You can tell us a little bit about it then.
Indulge us.
Yeah.
Let us know what it is.
It's basically a Kentucky Fried Movie-like sort of series of sketches which keep interrupting the feature film Amazon Women on the Moon, which is apparently being sort of telecast late at night. And Dante did quite a few segments for it, and actually some of my favourite segments in it. Particularly... There was a couple of very funny segments called Critics Corner and Roast Your Loved One, where a sort of Siskel and Ebert type pair of critics review a viewer's life, and they both give it thumbs down, describe it as incredibly disappointing, which causes him to have a heart attack.
I want to see this now.
And then his funeral is a roast with a lot of sort of reasonably low-rent comedians, Rip Taylor, Henny Youngman, and his wife doing his response. That's very, very funny. And Dante also did the best-known segment, the post-credits segment, Reckless Youth, which is Carrie Fisher and Paul Bartel, who is hilarious, just so dry and droll and just wonderful, in a sort of spoof of a 50s hygiene film. And that's very, very funny indeed. There's a lot of really amusing stuff in the whole film, actually, is pretty good fun. It's no Airplane, but there's quite a lot of... good sketches in there. Most of the jokes hit for me rather than miss. And there's a particularly good sequence with Peter Horton and Michelle Pfeiffer as a couple who've just had a baby. But Griffin Dunne is their doctor and is refusing to give them their child. And that develops in a lot of very fun ways. It's hit and miss like any sketch movie, but it's more hit than it is miss, certainly. I really enjoyed it, and there's definitely... When you find out which segments Dante did, you can definitely see his stamp on them, particularly Reckless Youth, but certainly there's a very sort of identifiable... Joe Dante-ness to quite a bit of it.
Well, I guess I'll have to check it out after that.
It sounds pretty good. Sam and I were talking about it before the podcast started, and I remembered seeing what ended up being a segment from the movie as part of a documentary on one of Universal Monster DVDs. There's a sketch called Son of the Invisible Man, where it's like this guy that totally everybody can see, but he thinks he's invisible. So he's just like messing up everybody's card games, and they're like, "Oh no, what's happening?"
I love that.
it definitely seems like up my alley. I gotta check it out.
Yeah, I want to see this. Yeah, I guess the next one, and this is one of my favorites from Dante, but I guess it's just one of my favorite, very weird kind of comedies, and it's another movie that I grew up with. I used to watch it all the time. Is The Burbs. I don't even know how to describe this movie. It has a really good cast. It has Tom Hanks in one of my probably favorite roles that he's done. And he's married to...
I think the best way to describe The Burbs is The Watch, but not shitty.
Oh, possibly. I don't remember everyone in this movie. So, yeah. Tom Hanks married to Carrie Fisher, and I think their neighbor is like Bruce Dern, and Corey Feldman's in there somewhere, and I think Dick Miller was a garbage man or something. But yeah, basically these weird neighbors move into the street. One of them was Courtney Gaines, that really weird ginger guy who was in Children of the Corn. Yeah, so basically the neighborhood sort of like check it out, this really weird family, and wondering what the hell they are, and yeah, it's this paranoia gone crazy in the suburbs. It's a very clever, like, you know, I guess it'd be a satire, I guess, on that kind of thing. But you know, it takes a lot of ideas, but just forms this. It forms its own thing, and it's so weird. It's so out there. It's this really kind of awesome comedy horror.
So it's kind of like if you combine Blue Velvet and Rear Window and make it really wacky.
Exactly. I mean that's it in a nutshell. It's just so insane. I love it. I love everything about it. It just is so funny. No matter how many times I watch it, I still laugh. And yeah, I think it is just one of my favorite, you know, insane comedies. And just talking about it, I want to, you know, go watch it again, even though I really shouldn't be watching it right now, because, you know, for me it's late as we're recording and I have, you know, busy days ahead of me, but I would, you know, love to just sit and watch it again, just talking about it and thinking about it.
Sure, you'll make the time to watch Step Up on Blu-ray, but not a good movie.
Well, that was earlier when it wasn't late, and that was to watch something with my mom.
But you could have thought about that sooner.
Well, shut up.
And also, you should be educating her, not indulging her with fucking Step Up. But anyway, The Burbs is another one I really haven't quite discovered. I've seen it a few times. It's not one of my favourites. I think maybe that's the Tom Hanks factor. I'm not much of a fan.
I like him in this. I mean, yeah, I am kind of an R on Tom Hanks, but this is one of the things I really like him in. And I think it's just because it is just so insane, and he plays it really well.
I think maybe it's a more specific one than some of his others, and maybe the last time I popped it in the DVD player, I wasn't quite in the right frame of mind. But yeah, it's never been one of my particular favorites of Dante's. It's definitely one of his edgier films, though, there's an interesting sort of paranoia about the all-American neighborhood, and the subversion of that is quite interesting in terms of his cinema and where this sits in that. It's one I need to go back to, basically. I think it's probably one that at the moment I'm more interested in than a big fan of. But it's definitely an interesting and weird little movie, his filmography.
It is so weird. And, you know, I kind of remember, like, when I first saw it, And it was, I think it was just the fact that it was so bizarre is just what sold me on it. And I was, you know, a kid when I saw this. So, you know, going back to my early years, I was into weird movies. The weirder the better, apparently.
Well, nothing changes, eh?
Yeah. AJ, your comments on this movie?
Not really. I want to say I did see the whole thing, but not in one sitting. I think I kind of had to watch it in pieces because, like, I think at, like, one point it just, I saw it when I was really young, and it just got, like, too weird for me and, like borderline scary, so I had to turn it off and kind of, like, revisit
it. It does have a very, you know, kind of weird, I keep saying weird, but it is weird. But the sort of scary thing about it is just weird. It's this weird fucking family that creeps you out. But
it is a very creepy little movie. I certainly remember
one of the creepiest but most hilarious scenes is when they go over to the house of this family, and the Courtney Gaines, I think, is offering them food, but he's offering them like sardines out of the tin, and they just don't know what to make of it, and it's so creepy, but it's so hilarious of their reactions. Yeah, I like this movie a lot. Yeah.
I think that about covers that.
Yeah, so Gremlins 2, the new batch, which Gremlins 2 was basically spoofing itself.
And everything it is, I mean, like the world.
It is basically a gag about the very idea of making a Gremlins 2.
Pretty much.
and also about the kind of company that would do such a thing. it is easily... For me, I mean, I think it's probably Dante's most subversive film in a lot of ways. There is nothing that is sort of held sacred in this movie. You know, it recites Gremlins not in the lovely palatial Bedford Falls, but in New York City. You know, so it really does. It's not like he, like so many sequels, just went and made the same film again. Here, it's really changed emphasis as well. You know, there's much more emphasis on comedy here, particularly with the various ways that it changes the Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly on the incredible amount of satire of the media and of business, particularly of, you know, sort of Donald Trump-style businessman played by John Glover here. And
he's great.
And it really is just dead on. It's so funny.
And Sam, like we were saying before the podcast started, is that like this is probably the most Joe Dante of Joe Dante's movies. Like you can just totally see this guy standing behind the camera with the biggest grin in the world on his face, just loving every minute of it.
Yeah, I mean, I love Gremlins. I just love it. It's a wonderful movie, but you can see to a certain degree that there might be bits of that movie that other people could have made. You know, it's as a whole, it's very much a Joe Dante film, don't get me wrong, but not to the exclusion of all else. Gremlins 2, I couldn't imagine anyone else making this.
Yeah.
It's because it is so bound up with everything that his cinema is, you know, the references to previous to old films, particularly to B movies,
and with Robert Prosky's character as the you know, the chap in vampire makeup who's presenting the B movie program over on some, you know, shitty cable show. What is it, Attack of the Octopus People or something like that? And of course, you know, even in the casting itself, you know, casting Christopher Lee as the mad scientist, Dr. Catheter, which in itself is a great funny joke.
Yeah.
But Christopher Lee's glee at receiving his diseases is just wonderful. There's so much that's so much fun about it, but especially what he does with the gremlins and how he literally mutates the gremlins from the sort of vaguely mischievous things that they were in the original film to something much more unique in this movie.
Yeah, you get like a really weird variety of gremlins here, like the spider one, and I believe there was a Wicked Witch one, if I'm not mistaken. Wasn't there something
There's certainly a female gremlin.
I like to refer to that as the divine gremlin, because that ain't female.
Fair enough. Pardon me. No, fair enough. But you... I don't think there's a Wicked Witch one. You get one that's electrical. You get the brain gremlin, which is hilarious.
Like the super smart, eloquently speaking gremlin.
Yeah. Shoots one of them. Now, was that civilized? Clearly not. Fun, but no way civilized. I could sit here forever just quoting Gremlins 2. there are so many weird and wonderful things in it. Even before the Gremlins arrive, there's that fantastic scene where Billy's boss, who is trying to pick him up, takes him to this restaurant where they have moose. In this huge, ridiculous, imposing restaurant.
Oh yeah.
The way it literally fucks with the actual film itself at a certain point, you know, the gremlins actually get into the projection booth and start tearing the film out of the projector. You know,
and they take down Leonard Maltin.
They do.
It's meta on a level that, you know, I don't think many films had gone there before.
No.
In that respect.
No.
And I think it has the reputation of being as underrated as it is, because a lot of the people who went and saw it were going to think, oh, this is going to be just another Gremlins movie. And they were not ready for that level of satire and humor. So they just kind of looked at it and said, well, that wasn't the Gremlins. Like, this is terrible.
Whereas I think it's a better film than Gremlins. I think it's, first of all, it's the essence of Joe Dante's movies. If you want to understand Joe Dante, I mean, you shouldn't start with this film, but this is the film you need to see. As far as I can tell, anyway. I mean, get back to us, Joe, if I'm wrong. There's another one that... I also feel that way about, which we'll talk about in a minute. But, you know, it's... shit, I've lost my thread there.
Sorry.
It is just sort of the essence of everything that is his cinema, so it's squeezed down into 90 minutes of total insanity, and that's why I love it, and that's why it's not quite my favourite, but certainly my favourite Gremlins film.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of... You know, I put them both on the same level just because... I mean, they're very... They are kind of, you know, very different, but they're just so awesome.
Oh, I forgot my favorite bit of referencing and satire in it, which is when Phoebe Cates starts telling another sad story and the movie deliberately undercuts it. Oh, we don't have time for that, honey.
Yeah.
She starts talking about the Easter Bunny, is it?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Sam. I miss Phoebe Cates now. Come back, Phoebe.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I've mounted the Bring Back Bridget Fonda campaign, but certainly Bring Back Phoebe Cates campaign wouldn't be misplaced either.
I think that one should be the next Bring Back campaign.
Well, since we haven't succeeded with Bridget Fonda just yet, I think we're still working on that. But
oh, well, you never know. You might get through to Ms. Cates.
Yeah, we definitely want her back, but not for Gremlins 3.
Oh, no.
But no, Princess no. Caribou 2.
You're a strange man.
I am.
He doesn't deny that. Should we move along?
We should.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, I kind of want to just briefly touch on this. Let me try and talk without getting myself confused again. Okay. So one of like my all-time favorite shows from when I was a kid was Eerie Indiana. And, you know, Joe Dante had a lot to do with this show, and I just don't think people quite got it. But as a kid, this was the shit. This was awesome. And I rewatched it, when I was, watching as much Joe Dante as I could. And it was, it still held up. It was fantastic stuff. And it was so much fun. And Joe Dante, I mean, his episodes definitely are some of the best that the series had. He did, I'll just name the episodes. There was the Hole in the Head Gang, Heart on a Chain, The Losers, The Retainer, and Foreverwhere. And these are just, they're crazy, episodes, but they're just so interesting. They're so well done. And my favorite episode of the series was Heart on a Chain. And it was just this really interesting and, moving story. And it dealt with, loss and, it also dealt with, transplant. And it guest starred Danielle Harris, and she was pretty awesome in it. It was just overall this episode was fantastic. So revisiting things that I distinctly remember as a kid, and just seeing that for me it held up so well. It was a real joy to just watch, and Dante just did a great job.
Yeah, I remember your. Yeah, first coming on TV when I was a kid, and it was around the same time that Are You Afraid of the Dark kind of debuted on Nickelodeon, and that was kind of that was introduction to sort of getting into horror, kind of away from this when I was even younger. But and as good as Are You Afraid of the Dark was with certain episodes, you could tell that a lot more stock was put into Eerie Indiana in terms of, giving the characters this world to live in, and it's convincing and taking itself seriously, but still being just kind of nutso and crazy. It's like that Heart on a Chain episode. I remember that scene, I remember that episode. And at the end, even as a 7-year-old, I'm like, this is really heavy stuff, and you just didn't really get that in Are You Afraid of the Dark, which is kind of just Tales from the Crypt for Juniors, let's have a few scares and then go on home, but there was a lot more weight behind Eerie Indiana.
Yeah, it had, a lot behind it. It was very well written, and it had a lot of heart, too. I just definitely wanted to mention it, because, it's great stuff, and Dante did a lot of good work on it. So,
I literally haven't seen any of this since I was 12 or 13, so I don't remember. I remember enjoying the show, but I don't remember any of the individual episodes at all, so I can't really add much to this. The complete series has come out on DVD here, though, so I do intend to pick it up.
It's such a good rewatch, and it's nostalgic, but at the same time, it's like, I really wish that we could have shows like this, you know, aimed at a younger audience, but they're not like that anymore. And this was, you know, a rare one as well. Yeah, so shall we move along to Matinee?
Yes.
Let's.
I think we all very much like this film a lot.
Matinee is my favourite Joe Dante film. I just love it. It's just fantastic. And more than anything, I mean, I think to me it's a film that kind of defines very well how I feel about movies. Mm. You know, it's about us. You mm-hmm. know, it's about geeks. It's about people who love movies. Mm. And people whose lives are kind of marked by movies. You know, there's obviously other stuff going on around it. You know, it's a film set during the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course. Mm. But it is very much about a movie fan, I think, first and, you know, kind of at its heart. And I really love that about it, and it's something that I recognize a lot of stuff in. You know, even though I grew up 20, 30 years after that era.
Yeah, if Gremlins 2 was Joe Dante's style, like his filmmaking sensibility just on full display, Matinee is like this tribute to his inspiration.
Mm.
Like he's telling you right there, it's like, this is what got me into where I am today. This is what kind of inspired me to take these like kind of B movies, but then elevate them with all these different elements and make big budget, really crazy movies out of stuff that when I was a kid, like Roger Corman and William Castle would have made in a week for $10 and still have fun with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to say, I'm amazed that the rights were available, that nobody had ever made a B-movie called Mant before.
Mant.
That's genius.
We
should say, you know, it's about a kid whose hero, a sort of William Castle style filmmaker played by John Goodman, comes to launch his latest nuclear paranoia sci-fi in Key West on the weekend that the Cuban Missile Crisis is reaching its absolute apex. And it's sort of, it's a coming of age movie. It's a nuclear paranoia movie a little bit. You know, it's a teen romantic comedy as well. And all of those things, I think it does really, really well. And obviously it's a movie about movies as well, and does that beautifully too. I love the way it sort of combines all three of those sort of central stories, and I think it combines them really nicely. The sort of little romance between the main character and the sort of shy girl from school, played by Lisa Jacob, is actually really, again, quite nicely drawn and quite sweet and quite funny as well, particularly towards the end. I find myself totally charmed by it every time, you know?
Yeah, I did see it for the first time. I mean, I don't remember if I had seen it as a kid, but I'll just, you know, go along with it as if it were the first time. And one of the kids is actually the kid that was in Erie, Indiana, funnily enough. But it's just, it's just, it's glorious. It has so much of me in there, as well. Like, this is, you know, a lot of things of why I love films, and, you know, I think that's just the beauty of it, is it's Joe Dante's, you know, love letter to, you know, the stuff that got him into it. It's just such a great movie, and God, I think John Goodman was great in this.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say.
And it's such a personal movie about such a niche subject that it just kind of hurt when, like, barely anybody saw it.
Yeah, and though I've got to say, I don't know anyone who has seen it who doesn't love it, you know?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
That kind of movie.
Yeah, it's just one of those kind of concepts for a movie that, you know, for the kind of mainstream moviegoer, it just doesn't really appeal to them, so they kind of write it off, even with John Goodman involved. But yeah, it's just a totally warm, just totally affectionate movie, and it just leaves you with a smile on your face, and it's just such a good ride. And just for anybody to not want to watch it because, you know, it's about stupid old movies, it's set in the 60s, whatever. Mm. Like, they're really undercutting, like, how good of a movie this is.
Oh, totally. And it's not like, again, they're on... It's a gentler film than Gremlins 2, for example, but, you know, it's not like there aren't those sort of edges to it that, you know, define Joe Dante about it. You know, again, it's such a personal, such a specific film. And there are definitely those really fun moments that you can only really imagine coming from him. You know, the school bully being hired to dress up in the ant costume, and you know, the ways that go wrong are all, you know, that's very Dante again, and there's some lovely stuff with all of that, and yeah, and all of the nuclear paranoia stuff with Robert Picardo as well is great fun, and his underground bunker. Which is fantastic. And of course, Mant itself.
Yeah.
We see quite a bit of Mant, and
I want
more
to see
of it
the
on
whole thing.
The Laserdisc, and also available on YouTube. And it's about 15 minutes long in total, and man, it's funny. It's just, and so brilliantly straight face. You'll begin to metamorphose. Or change.
I just want to see a whole Mant movie.
Yeah, I mean, we all want to see Mant, but I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
Though I do wish somebody would get around to putting Matinee on Blu-ray with,
you
know, what exists of Mant and a proper commentary from Dante.
Yeah, that would be stunning.
Yeah. If we can have, in this day and age, were-sheep movies, we can have a were-ant movie. Come on.
As long as Joe Dante directs it, I'm kind of fine with that, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be down for that.
Or even on, like, a kind of a low-budget level, like Larry Blamire, who did The Lost Skeleton of Cadavra, he could take up, like, House of Mant or something.
House of Mant. Okay. Hey, give it a go, yeah.
Do we want to move on from Matinee?
Yeah.
It's quite a big jump after that, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, I mean, after that, he did some TV work, and then his next bigger film was Small Soldiers.
Yeah, 5 years later.
So...
And, as big a gap as there's ever been, I think, in his work. But
well, until more recently, I guess.
Is it sad that the thing I remember most about Small Soldiers from my youth was the Burger King tie-in that they had?
Yes.
They had like a barbecue onion cheeseburger to coincide
yeah,
with...
Yeah, that's really sad. Because it's a way better movie than that.
I know. I'm talking like right when it hit. Like, I didn't see it when it first came out, but when it started hitting HBO and started playing continuously throughout one of the formative summers of my youth, I got more and more into it.
Well, I made a mistake with Small Soldiers. I didn't see it at the cinema because, well, by that time I was 17, and it kind of looked like a kid's movie. And I should have taken note of who directed it, you know? because it definitely has more kiddie movie trappings than the likes of Gremlins. But it's definitely not a kid's movie. You know, it certainly, if it is a kid's movie, it's a kid's movie for really smart kids, which, and pardon me, a slight digression here, is what we're missing. You're welcome. So it's a smart, and again, quite nasty by the time it gets going, little kids movie. I really enjoy it now. What about you guys?
And it is kind of subversive, like in the way that, you know, like the, because it's about like the military chip that's a line of toys, and of course one line is like the all-American butch hero military guys, mm-hmm. and there's like all the deformed monsters, and the monsters are the good guys, so you have like Tommy Lee Jones voicing the leader of the actual soldiers, and they're like merciless, jingoistic, you know, just totally blind, like over-the-top action guys who just don't care about anything except destroying anything that's different. When you kind of think
it's incredibly subversive. And if anything, by coming out in 1998, it kind of came before its time. I mean, it's actually what it seems to me, looking at it now, is it plays like a satire of the War on Terror that was made before the War on Terror.
Yeah, you know, really, really weird way.
And again, you can't imagine that that's what they had in mind, because A, it hadn't happened yet, and B, you know, this is a mainstream kids movie from, I think it was Paramount or Universal. All right, fine.
Universal.
Okay, well, whatever. But, you know, it's a mainstream sort of tentpole release. And what you get is actually a satirical movie that, you know, if you want to start being all Fox News about it, is very America bashing and that.
Yeah, although you can also just kind of look at it as, you know, like in a lot of his movies, Joe Dante, you can obviously see that he has affection for the monster, like even in Gremlins, yeah, where you like have all the really nasty creatures and stuff. Gizmo is still like the little underdog dude you like. And even in like movies to come, even like his Masters of Horror episode, which I'm sure we'll kind of talk about. Like those zombie soldiers who come back from the grave, he's on their side. So even going too deep into it, like he always has an affection for like the outcasts, and it comes through in Small Soldiers in a big way.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that you can kind of draw a line with him and Guillermo del Toro. Obviously, del Toro doesn't do the satire really, but there is that sort of affection for the monster in both of their work, and it's definitely something that really comes through in Small Soldiers. Is very much a thematic thing in Small Soldiers, definitely. And actually, you know, that's something it's hammered home a little bit, because you know you've got David Cross, who's basically sort of stating that from the word go. But fortunately, you know, it does sort of he goes away for quite a lot of the film, and it's allowed to develop a bit more subtly than that. But it's also really anarchic and really good fun. You know, there's a lot of great cameos doing all the voices for the toys and things like that. I think it's Christina Ricci and Sarah Michelle Gellar are a couple of the Barbie dolls and stuff like that. There's a lot of really good fun work there. And the mix of practical and CGI works really well as well with the various animation and the puppets and things. So it's sort of on the cusp, really, in 98 of the two technologies, and they're combined really effectively, I thought.
Mm. Right there with you.
Yeah. I don't think there's, like, even much I can add to that. Because I think you've pretty much covered it. But I really enjoy Small Soldiers a lot. It's, I find it actually a very just interesting and entertaining film. And it definitely has that Joe Dante feel to it.
Also, just to make a general point here, people give Kirsten Dunst too much shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just saying, just throwing it out there.
I think she's fine in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't some of my favorite stuff that she's done. You know, she's fine in it, but it's not the one that I'd hold up. But just in general, people give her way too much shit.
And to be honest, you know, I'll take Small Soldiers over Jumanji any day.
Yeah, twice on Sunday. Yeah,
no, I agree. But I don't know, Kirsten Dunst wasn't the biggest fan of her in the Spider-Man movies, but I generally like her in everything else.
Well, you will get into the Spider-Man movies maybe on another show.
Yeah, but yeah. No, I have no real issue with her at all.
Yeah.
All right, seeing as we're probably going to have to wrap up pretty soon. Next, I guess, he did Haunted Lighthouse, which was an R.L. Stine adaptation. It's okay-ish. I don't remember it too much, but it's not the greatest. And it did have Leah Thompson and Christopher Lloyd in it. Randomly.
Oh, maybe I do have to see it.
I was going to say, wasn't Haunted Lighthouse, I want to say that, wasn't that like just like a half hour or something?
Yeah, I don't remember being like very long. I know, where did I see it? I saw it on TV somewhere.
Yeah, because I want to say it was like it played as like a theme park attraction. It wasn't like a theatrically released movie. It was, I think, like Gardens or something where, yeah. Like, oh, 3D spooky, all right.
Yeah, exactly. It's like 30 minutes. It's not so great. It is what it is. Like, yeah. That's all. I mean, I have really nothing else to say on it. He then did Looney Tunes Back in Action. I didn't really like it that much.
I last saw it in 2003, and I liked it then. I don't think I've even given it a second thought since. I couldn't tell you what about it I liked.
Yeah.
I do remember, like, kind of like this really weird, like, lab sequence, and it had Kevin McCarthy in it, as he is in a whole lot of other Joe Dante movies, reprising, again, his Body Snatchers bit. But he was actually in black and white screaming, "They're here! They're here!"
Yeah, so I don't know. I didn't feel it was the right time when it came out for a Looney Tunes film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that bad, but I don't really think it's that great either.
I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I really like about it, actually. certainly, first of all, it's a way better, way more faithful Looney Tunes film than Space Jam.
I can definitely agree with that. I don't like Space Jam at all.
Yeah, it actually feels like Looney Tunes, and there are good things and bad things about that. You know, Looney Tunes are meant to be 7 minutes long. They just are.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite work as a movie, but there are some really great sequences and some really funny jokes in it. I think, actually, it's probably as funny as Steve Martin's been since Bowfinger, which, okay, is not saying a whole lot, but, you know, credit where credit is due. And, man, when Steve Martin's funny, that's he's always really good. Funny. You know, he still just makes me laugh.
And the movie just kind of really works as this kind of weird time capsule of a time where, at one point, Hollywood thought, yeah, Brendan Fraser and Jenna Elfman can open a movie.
Yeah, that was brief, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Jenna Elfman is one of those people who, with the exception of her part in that in the film Edward Norton directed, Keeping the Faith, she just strikes me as curiously charmless.
She is good in Keeping the Faith.
Yeah. Surprisingly. Like I say, there's a curious lack of charm about her, and that really hurts this movie.
Yeah.
But there are some just dazzling moments, like that fantastic chase through the Louvre when Bugs and Elmer and Daffy are running through all of the paintings and taking on all of the characteristics of those paintings, you know.
Yeah.
That is just, animation-wise, it's beautiful, and comedically speaking, it's just really, really funny and clever. And that, for me, is kind of the high watermark of that movie. There are some nice bits aside from that, but yeah, it doesn't get there again. But I do enjoy it, and as I say, it's a better movie, I think, than its reputation. It's just not as good a movie as it should be.
Yeah, I think you nailed it with that.
I do remember the day I saw it. I saw that first, and then I saw Master and Commander right after. It was an interesting double feature.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's only really a couple of things left. After this, I mean, his next movie would, I mean, it. I don't even know if it's even out in the US yet. It was made in 2009, but before that, he did two episodes of Masters of Horror, being Homecoming and the Screwfly Solution. I said that completely wrong. I don't remember the second one, but Homecoming, I think, was one of the best of the series that I'd seen. It's just, it's a great little short. I mean, Masters of Horror is really, you know, short films, yeah. I guess. But Homecoming is really good. It's odd. It's a little different, I think, for Dante, but it definitely has that very dark, it's so hard to explain.
I kind of feel like it's like the flip side of John Landis on that show, who had like one of the worst episodes of the first season and one of the best of the second one. Homecoming, that was one of the best of season one. Like, that was a really good episode amongst all these others that were kind of hit and miss. But the Screwfly Solution, Sam, if you thought The Howling didn't feel like Joe Dante, this really doesn't either. It's really, really dark. It's like, it's the story about where men are driven by like some outbreak or whatever to violently attack women. And like, it has some kind of interesting points to it, but I just remember just being so mad at the episode because the daughter in that episode is one of the 10 dumbest people I've ever seen in any horror related property. Just throwing herself into danger just because she's a whiny little fucking teenager. Like, it just made me so mad.
That's a shame, because that's the sort of thing I can imagine Joe Dante doing something really fun with, you know, making fun of the fact that she's stupid, you know, and having a good time with it.
I don't know. It's played pretty straight here, so I don't think it was like, oh, idiot horror girl cliches.
Yeah, I mean, because that I could imagine him having a really good time with. But yeah, Homecoming I thought was fine. I haven't seen Screwfly. Homecoming it was fine. I felt it was politically a little on the nose, to be honest. And actually, now that I sort of thought of the comparison, I think actually Small Soldiers might be the more sort of interesting commentary on, you know, American military from him, you know?
I can see that.
Yeah.
And without being quite so, without hammering it home quite so much as Homecoming does. It's not a bad episode. I think it's probably, you know, among the top few of the first season, but it's very hit and miss that season. And the only one I thought was particularly really good was probably Sick Girl.
Yeah, that exactly. Might be my favorite one. And yeah, it was a real pleasure to actually talk to Marky McKee about it when I did last year. Because, yeah, that for me, I think, was the highlight of that season from what I'd seen. And yeah, this leads us to the last thing, last feature that he did. And I happen to think it is his worst, I guess. I did not like this at all. There's The Hole, or The Hole in 3D. I didn't like it at all. It does have this, you know, Dante feel, but it's very just child. I don't know. It feels childish, like aimed at very, very young kids. And maybe that's why I didn't like it at all. But, you know, the story's intriguing. It's an interesting story. But the script, the dialogue, it's not good. And the kid actors are terrible. I just wanted to hit them. And I don't want to, you know, normally I don't feel violence towards children. But I just, that was so irritating. I wanted to slap them.
I don't know, have you ever been in a Walmart?
I have, but I was lucky that it wasn't that busy. but no, I didn't really like this at all. You know, it has some really interesting visuals, but at other points, it's just not that well shot. I just found this to be very irritating. I didn't find it like, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that they really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. I didn't find it fun. I didn't think it was very good. If I was a kid, you know, if I was 6 years old, I probably would have enjoyed it. But I just found it was just badly, everything was just not good. The kids especially just irritated me, and I just didn't think the script was very good. I was so disappointed with how it turned out. I was really excited to see it. But I just think it's really poor, and it looks cheap. It looks very cheap for what it is. Like, it shouldn't look that cheap.
I need to go back to it, because like you, I've heard a lot of good things about it. But like you, I've only seen it at the cinema, and I wasn't a fan, really.
Yeah.
I think my problem really was that it kind of felt like Joe Dante by numbers.
Yeah.
You know, where the thing that I think is really great about him is that there's such invention to his films, and there's a feeling that I get when I walk into one of his movies that I don't know what I'm going to get when I sit down. And that's really exciting for me and for anyone. But I felt like he had done all of these things before in various different movies, and that this combination of those things wasn't massively interesting, wasn't anything terribly new for him. And I just felt like it needed something a bit different to, just to kick it into life, really.
Yeah, I did feel it was kind of a bit lifeless as well. It wasn't that interesting, and it just felt very, like I said, it just felt childish. Like, it's not something that, for me, could appeal to older people. It felt like it was meant to be just for 6-year-olds, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. I got nothing out of it. I really didn't like this at all.
But not that said, a lot of people have really enjoyed it, and
maybe I missed something, and a lot of
people who I trust on Dante's Films as well. So I do want to go back to it and
I'm thinking, do I need to see it again? But I don't know if I can stand those kids. I'm going to want to kill them, and that's so wrong. But they were so irritating, I just don't know if I can sit through them. And I mean, no offense or anything when I say I wanted to kill the kids. Yeah. I don't literally want to kill them. I just don't want them in the movie.
As far as I know, there isn't a U.S. release date for The Hole yet. So, like, if I do ever get to see it, I'll let you guys know.
You have to let us know. Yeah, I know that there's a few movies.
It's better than that. You know.
Well, it's released here, so I don't understand why it's not out. But, I do think Dante has some things in pre-production. I think Monster Love is still on, as far as I know.
See, that's a film I want to see just based on the fact that it's called Monster Love and it's directed by Joe Dante. I mean, I'm sold. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, I have hopes that, what he does next will be, good. But I got to mention one thing. I have watched the TV series reboot, I guess, of Hawaii Five-0, and Joe Dante did do the Halloween episode of this last season, and it was a riot. He actually had Robert Englund in the episode, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, it's a fun show. I really like it, but his episode was just one of the best they've actually had. It was pretty awesome. He really, brought something special to it. And I mean, he is a busy man. He started the Trailers from Hell website, which I absolutely love. And for those not in the know, the website basically has, you can watch, trailers for all sorts of films, but the kick is they'll have a commentary over it from, all sorts of people, and Dante has done a lot, and you can actually watch the trailer with the commentary or without. You can watch, watch it with the commentary first and watch it without, or vice versa, and, there's a lot of great people on the site. It's a lot of fun. If you haven't been on there, I mean, get on there. It's pretty cool.
That's the thing about Joe Dante, is that even though I haven't seen a good deal of his movies in a long time, that there's all these documentaries out, like, Corman's World. And
which is awesome.
Machete Maidens Unleashed. Yeah. And like, all these documentaries about, B-horror, about exploitation movies, and he's interview subject. I even want to say on Universal's Bride of Frankenstein DVD, there's an actual, there's a documentary about that he actually hosts. And through all these interviews you see with him, like, he really has a love for not only, like, filmmaking, but for like the genre stuff that he grew up watching and kind of inspired him. And it really says something when you see him talk about all these exploitation movies, and even though a lot of them are really awful and are really terrible, he still makes you kind of want to see him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's really entertaining. He's a great guy to listen to. And if you can find, like, some documentaries that he's been in or interviews that you might find on YouTube, I mean, listen to the guy. He's very entertaining. He's very knowledgeable. And, you know, I think he's just a really great guy. Like, I can sit and listen to him for hours. It's just, yeah. It's a real pleasure. And, you know, I definitely would say check out Corman's World. I mean, this goes through a lot of his, Corman's earlier stuff. And, you know, Dante and Arkish are on there. And you definitely kind of find out about how they got started in the business. And, you know, it's good stuff. And, yeah, I mean, any time he's in a doco and, you know, he has something to say, I mean, it's very interesting. I think another good one was American Grindhouse, which I think he's in a lot too.
These are all things that I need to check out, I've got to say. I just haven't got around to these just yet.
Yeah, they're worth checking out.
Corman's World is worth it just for the scene where Jack Nicholson cries.
He cries. I was stunned when I saw him actually literally crying. The stuff about, I mean, this is kind of off topic, but when Corman is talking about, like, you know, he wanted to make a legitimate, like, movie and it was so poorly received. I can't remember what it was called. It had William Shatner in it.
Oh, The Intruder?
Yeah, and it was, it didn't go over well. And, you know, his heartbreak about it, and, you know, William Shatner talks about it. I actually haven't seen that film, but after watching it, I really wanted to. You know, there's just, yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, was The Intruder. Basically, that was Joe Dante in a nutshell, because we could probably just go on for, you know, another 10 hours about his films and his contributions and...
Five hours on Dick Miller cameos alone.
Well, pretty much. and we do really love Dick Miller. He's so memorable. He's that guy. You know, I can remember seeing him in so much stuff. Like, I distinctly remember him when I see him. Because he, you know, and it's just a wonderful, thing that they've just been working together for so long. Like, he's always
I'm kind of surprised that Joe Dante didn't direct Demon Knight.
I still haven't seen that, and don't tell me off about it.
I haven't seen it either.
That one's fine. If you haven't seen Bordello of Blood, though, we're going to have a talking to.
I don't know if I have. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff I need to watch, but...
It's Dennis Miller, Super Soaker with Holy Water.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's probably a wrap on the podcast.
Yes, indeed.
I would just like to thank Joe Dante for his wonderful films and contributions and just for being such a cool dude. Something I keep forgetting to do on the podcast, which I might as well do now, is where we can all be found. I can be found, and I'll be serious for today. You can find, obviously, the website at supermarcy.com, and you can look up Super Podcast on Facebook and like the page, and you can follow me on Twitter at supermarcy, and you can also email me if you want to tell me how absolutely awful the podcast is. You can just send an email to marcy@supermarcy.com. AJ, where can people find you? And I do believe you have a brand new review site.
I do. I've been getting back into the writing game, and it feels good. And you can find me at Cineslice. That's CineSlice .wordpress.com. I just put up my review of the 2009 sci-fi miniseries version of The Phantom, which actually has gotten a surprising amount of views so far, so I super record.
So you must have done something good.
I know. So you can visit that, or I'm on Twitter as well, at MadMovieMan, so you can holler at me or tell me how damn sexy my voice is.
Your voice is damn sexy, AJ.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And Sam.
I'm
going to
head start on you on that score, sir. I have an English accent. Okay. In all seriousness, you can find me writing about movies at www.24fps.org.uk. You can find me writing about music at www.whateffingianguy, that's EFFING, whateffingianguy.wordpress.com, or you can find me writing about random bullshit on Twitter at 24FPSUK. And there is also a Twitter for the music website, at What Effing Ian. So, yeah, busy, busy, busy.
Yes. And, yeah, so that's it from us. And be sure to tune in to the next episode of the Super Podcast, which we're hoping is going to be our episode where we are going to pitch a movie for the Asylum. So... keep your eyes and ears open for that one. So, you know, if everything goes according to plan, that will be our next podcast. So until then, I have been very Australian and AJ's been awful and Sam's just been British. So catch you later.